Merry draft eve, everybody. Got a lot to get to here. Going to go through four more of the prospects that are projected for late lottery, mid-first round. Also need to unveil at the end of the episode Danny and I's draft boards, at least of the guys that we did full scouting reports on. So it's only, I think, eight guys. But nonetheless, it'll be interesting to get that down and go back and look at how wrong we were in a little bit. But first, we got to get to some news here, starting with a trade. We have a trade.
We actually have two trades, but we'll start with the far more significant one to the league landscape. So the trade as it is, you know, it hasn't been consummated because this trade won't happen until the league year turns over. But it is Dwight Howard going finally to the Brooklyn Nets 6 years after it was originally going to happen.
Oh, yeah. I woke up and I saw that the trade had happened, and I just started scrolling back down through my tweets, which I always do in the morning to see what I missed while I was asleep. And I was just waiting for the Bobby Marks tweet about how, like, Dwight finally made it to the Nets because he was there in 2012 with the Dwight Mayer drama.
Well, and it was funny for me because I recorded a radio spot for Charlotte like 5 minutes after the trade happened. So I had to process it quickly, but I enjoyed that. And so the trade is Dwight Howard going from Charlotte to Brooklyn in exchange for Timofey Mozgov and 2 second-round picks. One of them is number 45 this year. The other one is in 2021. And then they also, the Charlotte Hornets, received cash in the transaction.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how much cash, in fact, that is. Let's start with the motivation here from the Nets' perspective. They save Mozgov's $16.8 million salary for the 2019-20 season. So that opens up a lot more cap room for them in the summer of 2019. They have to take on more this year in terms of Dwight Howard. The reason this trade can't be consummated until after the league year turns over is because the Nets, the salaries don't match. And so therefore, the Nets have to have cap space to take on the extra amount of Howard's salary beyond what would match. And they can only do that once the league year turns over. So now the Nets looking to be players in the summer of 2019, as a lot of teams are right now. But if they wanted to keep the cap hold of D'Angelo Russell, which is over $21 million, and also Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, both of whom will be restricted free agents that offseason on the books, they can get up to $42 million in space, dump Russell, dump Hollis-Jefferson's cap holds, and you're well over $60 million. They'll have a draft pick, of course, for the first time in 4 years as well. And then also Allen Crabbe is another big salary that comes off the books the year after, but he has a player option there. Probably won't opt out. Probably not quite ridiculous enough to deserve the voice there. Probably won't opt out, but one that could maybe be moved as an expiring contract at the end. There he is, a player who has some modicum of value, even if it's not $18.5 million worth. So that's the motivation from the Nets standpoint. And to do that, they basically traded these 2 second-rounders, not amazing ones. You know, they also had number 40, and apparently Charlotte couldn't get that. They only really get 45 in this deal. And so they are setting up to be potentially free agent players in the summer of 2019.
What is most surprising to me about this trade is not so much Charlotte moving 2019-20 money for the benefit of 18-19, you know, getting richer this year. It's that they also, depending on how this is structured, and there is still flexibility in this, and I'll explain that in a second, it looks like Brooklyn's also punting on their space in 2018. And that, I think, is in some ways the biggest consequence for them of this trade, is that they had this little pool of money. I had it at about $13 million. It depends on a few things, like whether Joe Harris was coming back, Isaiah Whitehead, but around that amount of money. And plus the room mid-level exception, because that they would function as an under-the-cap team in that hypothetical. You know, they could have done something with that. And of course, the money they would have used, that would have taken away, theoretically, from their space in the summer of 2019, which you just laid out very well. But they also could have theoretically gotten an asset from another team. They could have done numerous other elements. There is a way for this for them to have their cake and eat it too. Basically, the trade doesn't work as constructed, but Brooklyn could send out a little bit more money that probably would not be going to Charlotte. It would probably be going to a third team to make this work under the trade rules. And then in that circumstance, they could function incidentally as either an over the cap or under the cap team, depending on how they structured their holds and whether they preferred the mid-level or cap space. I don't expect that to happen, but it could, and they don't have to make a decision on that until the moratorium is over, because that's when this deal actually happens.
Yeah, because if they have to use cap space, then their exceptions become limited. A couple more things about this from the Brooklyn perspective. You mentioned the opportunity cost. I think that's an interesting one. Now, you know, they could have been maybe a Kenneth Faried destination. They maybe could have been a Jared Bayless destination, but unclear if a first round pick would have been possible there. Now, another thing that we had suggested that they might do is maybe just try to move Damari Carroll. And maybe if you move Damari Carroll, who can actually play, and you pick up a Bayless, probably not Bayless because the Sixers would be using for cap space, probably not Fareed either because you're now, the Nuggets want to reduce money. So the idea would have been if you move someone like Carroll is you take on more money past 2019 and then give back a player who can play, and now you're getting draft pick compensation. I don't think just straight up taking on Bayless or Fareed looked like that was going to get them as much as, say, a first round pick. But this trade is bad news for teams that are trying to get off of money right now, because it looks like, number one, the Nets don't want to take on any money that goes through 2020. Those are really bad contracts. And now they don't necessarily have the space to do it for even a contract that only has one more year remaining.
This trade, for the time being, is also bad news for Jared Allen. Allen really showed some things last year. I liked him quite a bit in the draft process. We saw him at the Hoop Summit. I also liked him a lot last year as a member of the Brooklyn Nets. And it's always hard when you bring in a high-profile player to think that they will be marginalized in favor of a young guy who's up and coming, even though the Nets are still a young team, you know, trying to figure out who their core is. So it could be harmful there. There's also the possibility that Howard just gets bought out at some point. That could either be soon or that could be later on, depending on what he prioritizes, how much money is left on the table, all that sort of stuff. But just at first blush, because one of the consequences of this trade for both teams is that Dwight Howard is a meaningfully better basketball player right now than Timofey Mozgov, is how that affects both.
Yeah, meaningfully better, maybe on the court, but of course, big surprise, Dwight Howard's act had grown tiresome in the Charlotte locker room, according to reports. And the Nets do have this really nice culture. I don't know if they want to mess that up necessarily. I mean, it seems like Dwight does want to be there, perhaps. And he can still play a little bit. I think a lot of it depends on how his back and knees are feeling on a night-to-night basis. I don't like the idea of the Nets winning more games in this first year that they have their draft pick in quite some time. And you mentioned the developmental consequence potentially for Jared Allen. Another consequence of this is it would greatly reduce the chances of D'Angelo Russell and the Nets agreeing on an extension. I thought the chances of that were pretty low anyway. I'm sure Russell would demand a lot of money as just the former number two overall pick, and the Nets, in terms of his health, in terms of his impact on winning, shooting percentage, all those things, just with that injury plagued year, the surgery, have not seen nearly enough to really want to commit big money. So it probably wasn't going to happen anyway, but now it's really not going to happen, you would think, because that would eat into their potential. And they figure, hey, you know what, if he really blows up next year, we'll still have his restricted rights anyway if we need them, but we'd rather just keep our options open. And it's not a question of, oh, using his low cap hold and then signing to a contract on top of that. It's kind of going to be more of an either or proposition likely with the cap space, because his cap hold at $21 million as the number two overall pick is so large. And this, those guys at the very top of the draft are the ones where increasing it from 200% makes it like a much different proposition in terms of how big his cap hold is. But that's another thing to watch here. And another thing too to note is, like, all these teams with 2019 aspirations, there's going to be a lot of teams out there right now. I'm going to take a look at my sheet, and this is very much subject to change with trades, etc., but I've got 15 teams right now that project to have $20 million or more in cap space. Again, when free agents get signed, when free agents get re-signed, you know, that's very, very much going to change. But it will be a different market almost assuredly in 2019. And then also, this is bad news for free agents this year in 2018, and good news for those teams that still have some cap space. I mean, it is just going to be such an ugly market if you're a team or if you're a player looking to get a contract above the mid-level. We've talked about that ad nauseum.
Yeah, and it's even harder if you're a player who's trying to get a contract at the mid-level at this point, because it just takes out another team that you could have used for leverage to get the full mid-level out there, because there weren't really many in that kind of low teens range where it looked like the Nets were going to be. So they aren't the Brooklyn leverages for that, and for the time being at least.
Yeah, restricted free agents also can't be too happy about that. We'll turn to Charlotte's perspective right after this from Lightstream. Here's an easy way to save some money. You can lower the interest rate on your credit card debt with a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream. If you are a consumer with good credit, you can get a great interest rate and no fees. Their credit card consolidation loans start at just 5.89% APR. if you opt into their auto pay. I don't know about you, guessing that's probably a cheaper rate than you're paying on a credit card. You could choose your funding date, which could be even as soon as today. Again, if you have good credit, but maybe just a little bit more credit card debt than you might like, these consolidation loans are fantastic. Their website, you know, Lightstream, is a very good way to describe their website, I would say. It's intuitive, easy to navigate, not a difficult process. What's more, my listeners get an additional interest rate discount on top of Lightstream's already low rates. The only way to get that discount is to go to lightstream.com/capspace. That's LIGTSTREAM.com/capspace. Easy to remember because we talk about capspace all the time in the program. That's lightstream.com/capspace. Of course, those rates are subject to credit approval. Includes the 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com for more information. So a lot of people were really killing this trade for Charlotte. This is Mitch Kupchak's first move, of course. The beautiful symmetry of him acquiring the toxic Timofey Mozgov contract that got him fired in LA, among many other things, of course, is not lost on me. Did you hate this trade as much for Charlotte as some others did? I think like KP gave him a D+. He's usually more judicious with his grades than we are when it comes to negative grade. I think he didn't really seem to care for it. What do you think?
I wouldn't go quite that far, but I do think that it is a big opportunity. It's an opportunity cost for them, but not nearly as big for Charlotte as it would have been for other teams, because they were not one of those franchises in 2019-20 that was really looking to have a lot of money. So they're not hamstringing themselves beyond just the financial constraints of having another guy who makes a lot of money and isn't particularly good. So that part of it, I don't think is, in a vacuum, it's worse than it is for them. The other challenge with Charlotte, what makes them different from a lot of these teams, is we knew they weren't going to pay the luxury taxes here. So if you treat that as a constraint, then one of the goals is to make the best team possible if they're not going to trade Kemba Walker. And I think this is a big sign saying we're not trading Kemba Walker, at least not right now.
Which is bad. But I think that was always the case.
Sure, it's the wrong decision for them.
Mitch Kupchak didn't get hired by saying, "Oh, hey, we're going to come in and we're going to trade Kemba Walker." Mitch Kupchak is very experienced at doubling down on already hopeless situations, and that is apparently how he got the job, by convincing Michael Jordan. But that's already died in the wool. I don't think that we can say that like this is a bad trade because of that.
Because of that. Yeah. Right. And what's funny about it from that perspective is I mentioned I personally feel that Dwight Howard is meaningfully better right now than Timofey Mozgov. You can say that part doesn't matter as much to them because it's more Dwight Howard versus Willy Hernan Gomez, because who Charlotte gave up 2 second-round picks for at the deadline and is now the backup center in waiting. So that is still a meaningful difference. It makes, this is a point Kevin noted in his piece, is that this makes Charlotte a lot more susceptible to injury. This is much more similar now to 16-17 when their season was derailed in no small part because of Cody Zeller missing time.
Yeah. And I'll never forget that stat of them going 3-17 in the 20 games that he missed from that year.
Yeah. And also now the big benefit for Charlotte is that they get use of either the full mid-level exception or really close to it, which will help them get a lot better. The problem with that in terms of center depth is they're not going to use that on a center, presumably back a point guard, maybe something on the wing, just use it to make the team better. There are a couple different ways they can do so. Overall, I think, clearing money for this year can make them better if that is something that is important to Charlotte for whatever reason. And we might be seeing a playoff spot open in the East, depending on what happens to LeBron James. If Cleveland ends up breaking up, then that ends up bringing a spot. There also could be injuries. Many things could happen. So that part of it is, it's disconcerting, but it's not necessarily awful for their specific circumstance.
Here's a couple ways to think about this trade that make it maybe not look as bad. Now, you can quibble with whether this inception or not. One is, remember, in the late 30s, teams buy picks for $3.5 million. It's probably more like $2 million once you get into the mid-40s. We don't know where Brooklyn will be in 2021, but probably, around the middle of the league. So you're talking about two picks that are probably around 45. And so if you buy picks, you buy those picks for like $4 million, they took on an extra $8.9 million in salary. Granted, some of it extends a year past, but if you look at just the salary, so you're taking on an extra $8.9 million in salary for 2 seconds that are kind of milling. All right, but you also got some cash as well, so to maybe equal that out, and we'll see how much that cash ends up being. I'm guessing it'll be pretty significant. That's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is, in this day and age, an extra $9 million or so in salary, you know, that's 2 seconds is kind of the going rate for that, as long as they're not like two really bad seconds. You'll recall the Bulls getting off of Jose Calderon's money, which was about $8 million in the summer of 2016, when there was much more money around, by the way, to the Lakers for 2 second round picks. And so that's maybe another way to look at it, is that this is to take on that extra amount of money for 2 second round picks is not totally ridiculous, especially when you're getting some cash as well. Like, that value proposition is not totally out of whack to me. And the other thing that Charlotte gets here is, if they are trying to compete, they've now got some spending room. I've got them right now with the cap hold for Trevion Graham, although it seems now that Graham can probably be gotten with an offer sheet. But with that, with the 11th pick, assuming they don't pick up their non-guarantee on Julian Stone, I have them at about $6.4 million below the tax line. And obviously you can't, I mean, they could go over for a little bit, but Charlotte is not interested in paying the tax. That is obviously was another huge driver of this. It was for a lot of their transactions last year. But they at least have enough money now. They could probably spend about $4 million, leave themselves about $2.5 million below the tax to sign some more guys and conduct some more business if they want to sign this second round. I mean, they already have, with Graham and with the 11th pick, they already have 13 roster spots accounted for. And there are guys out there in that free agent market now, because that's the other thing that's torpedoed them in recent years, is just absolute terrible backup point guard play. And so with the being armed with that amount of money, you know, maybe they can at least get a credible backup, a Raymond Felton, you know, someone along those lines. Probably not enough to get like an Isaiah Thomas, but they've at least got some money here. Although maybe like Milos Teodosic could be someone they could look at if he comes available, as we talked about yesterday. Hopefully something in the backup point guard market could emerge that they could feel decent about. That's clearly their number one need. But the point was made now that you're keeping Kemba Walker around for right now. Well, if Marvin Williams and MKG opt in, could see actually MKG potentially opting out in the summer of 2019. We'll see what kind of year he has. But if they re-sign Walker for anything close to what his going rate is probably going to be, you know, you're right back in tax hell, maybe not tax hell, but tax hack once again. So this is a component of kicking the can down the road, especially if they sign a backup point guard for more than 1 year with that $4 to $5 million or so that I anticipate that they will have to work with. You've still potentially got tax problems, but, you know, probably not, because Kemba Walker seems unlikely to be on this team. But even without him, they would have $10 million in space, and they would suck, so they really wouldn't be in the free agent market, at least the top of the market, in 2019. I don't think, as you said at the beginning, that there's this huge opportunity cost for them for taking on this money in 2019. Anything else you wanted to add on this one?
Yeah, one other thing, which is, if we take it as a constraint, as I would, that Charlotte had to get under the tax, a lot of the other ways they would have done that would have cost them assets. So that would be, and remember, Charlotte, they have their own first round picks moving forward. They do not have their own 2018 second. You know, they have, because of the just an outstanding trade from, like, I think it was 2016.
Yeah, the Courtney Lee trade, I want to say.
I believe that's right. So
a good trade,
it would have been
hard for them.
It would have been hard for them to do that in a way that would really work, because they don't have a lot of good value contracts. The players they have, you know, maybe theoretically at the end of days, somebody would have taken, like, not have taken on Jeremy Lamb for nothing, but taken on Jeremy Lamb with a menial asset, something like that. But I wouldn't have played the game for that. So if you take that as a given for them, this is not the biggest consequence for it. And when you consider that their only draft asset this year is the 11th pick, which is way too strong to unload that kind of money, there might not have really been a middle ground here. And so they were able to do it by taking on money for next year. And I mean, I'm guessing there are some other teams that might be kicking themselves that an offer like this wasn't available to them, because there are a lot of teams that have money for next season that they would rather not have on their books right now.
I mentioned Graham, you know, their need clearly is a backup point guard. So once you get to within a little bit of the tax, I mean, it seems unlikely that even, you know, a $3 million a year offer sheet necessarily would be something that Charlotte would match. I don't know if there's anybody out there who thinks Trevion Graham is a $3 million a year player, but I might take a flyer on him for that amount of money. We've talked about him quite a bit here. One other thing we should probably discuss, though, is the irony of this series of transactions for Charlotte.
Yeah, I put together kind of the transaction log here. So last summer, Charlotte traded away Miles Plumlee, Marco Bellinelli, who was an expiring contract, and the 41st pick for Dwight and number 31. They incidentally then traded down from 31 to 40 for cash. So you know, that's really what the draft pick part of that ended up being for the Hornets. And then this summer, they traded Dwight for Mozgov, 45, and 2021 second. So the net trade was Miles Plumlee, Marco Bellinelli, and then the 41st pick in 2017, which became Tyler Dorsey, for Timofey Mozgov, the 31st pick, the number 45 this year, and that 2021 second. And so Plumlee, in many ways, is what they were actually looking for, because while Mozgov, to me, is better than Plumlee, Plumlee was about $3.5 million cheaper.
Most people would say Plumlee is better than Mozgov. It's
I would have to think about it a little bit, and I don't want to think about it a little bit.
No, I don't think we should. And Mozgov, you mentioned, like, Mozgov could maybe play some minutes for them as a third center next year.
Yeah, sure. And so basically they got back what they want. I mean, you should also, I should also note that in that, Charlotte also got a year of Dwight Howard, and Dwight Howard had a pretty productive year for them. He was their starting center when he was healthy. And so they got that, but it's amazing that they made that move kind of, and I was a big supporter of the Dwight Howard trade from Charlotte's perspective. And then they basically undid it in a pretty remarkable way.
I mean, I don't think that, like, Dwight Howard was the reason they didn't make the playoffs last year. Those,
hey, we have to give Michael Carter-Williams plenty of credit for that on this podcast.
All right, we do have another trade, a little bit more low level, but one that does have some interesting implications. The Lakers have acquired the 39th pick from the Sixers. The Sixers actually have 4 second rounders, and this is another one that isn't going to be able to be complete until the league year, because Philly in 2019 is getting the Bulls pick, which went to the Lakers in the aforementioned Calderon deal, and of course the omnipresent cash. Philly, however, cannot receive any cash until the league year turns over. They've already accepted their maximum $5.1 million for this season.
Well, and that could potentially be significant for the Lakers, because the Lakers, if they have a successful free agency, one of the hallmarks of those teams trying to kind of clear stuff and get things moving is to use cash in trades. And so this will, I don't know how much it'll be, but this will reduce their allocation for the 19-20 season.
Yeah. Another nice thing, though, is that if they want to bring a guy in and they want to use cap space, that a second rounder doesn't count for anything against the cap the way a first rounder does. So that's useful if they want to bring in who they get at 39. And also, we'll see what the amount actually ends up being, but I haven't seen that report anywhere yet. And also remember that they're sending out this Bulls pick. I mean, that Bulls pick is probably due to be right around number 39 or so next year, I would guess. But in a worse draft, and the time value that, so that, you know, the cash, it wouldn't shock me if the cash were more like, you know, $1 million or something. I don't think this is going to be, you know, a $3 million transaction when you consider the pick going back.
Agreed.
So I think they'll still have plenty of money. The Lakers will. And I don't think the Lakers have used any of their cash for this year yet. So maybe they could still use some for this year and then some for next year. But, and that is one pick, though, that maybe the Warriors could have bought, for example, that maybe a Houston could have bought, that now is no longer going to be available. But you could see even Philly, with how many guys they have in their roster, with Jonah Bolden coming over reportedly next year, they could even sell their other decent second rounder as well.
Which I believe is the pick immediately preceding this one. And it makes sense that they would want to do that. Or the other significance for me with this, and why I thought it was a little bit strange, this happens every once in a while, is that when it's a pick later in the draft, and where this is the whole trade, it's not like in the Charlotte Brooklyn deal where the pick that changed hands was not the most significant part of the trade, where you just never know who's going to be available, and it's possible that, you know, that the market could be there. However, you know, getting a second round pick, which is probably going to be at a similar level, maybe they would rather have that than cash. So there's a possibility for Philly. But I don't know. I'm always of the style of maybe a guy who a team is really interested in falls a little bit further, and then you could get some value there. It seems like this offer would have been there no matter what, but it's not a big deal.
Some player option news. Dwayne Dedman opting in to $7.2 million for next season with the Hawks. That's, I think, what we had projected. Also project that Mike Muscala will opt in there. That'll leave the Hawks with a little over $20 million or so in space. Does it surprise you at all that Dedman is opt in, or you think this is, I mean, it wasn't clear cut to me, but I think this is what I anticipated would happen.
It's what I anticipated as well. It was, to me, it was closer to 50-50 than most, but I don't think he was going to get $7.2 million, and I don't think that waiting an extra year is going to be a big deal. Also, Dedman, if he's not moved before then, and now theoretically he's actually trade eligible on draft night, I don't think any team's going to make a move on him that early. But theoretically, he can do what his predecessors Marco Bellinelli and Arisani Ilyasova did, which is if the Hawks end up being bad, he can just get a buyout in February and end up on a team for the stretch run anyway.
Yeah. Now, certainly, Dedman is another guy who can help a team. It showed a little bit of stretchability last year, which was a new development for him. And Mark Deeks was really surprised that he opted in I'm not as surprised, but I think the league doesn't value Dedmon maybe as much as he does. And I think you and I are a little more lukewarm on him. But I think generally that was not an incredibly surprising decision. And we know that Dedmon has had no qualms about opting out because he did it last summer. And it looked like he really might get squeezed. And then he was able to get that 1+1, you know, starting at about $6 million last year. So $6 million per season and the player option that he opted into. So that ended up being the right decision to opt out last year. So he's not afraid of doing that. I think his agent did a good job last year of helping him opt in or out and, you know, presumably did the same this season. Opting out, Kyle O'Quinn in New York, $4.2 million declined player option. He will be an unrestricted free agent. And this is another one where it doesn't really affect the Knicks cap space that much unless Enes Kanter were also to opt out, which he's actually made some noises about doing. I would be shocked if he actually does it, but it's not impossible. So, you know, we'll see with O'Quinn. I mean, this is one of those ones where maybe he just hopes he can get a little bit longer term of a deal, but with the center market as tight as it is, you do wonder about that.
And we'll see what he prioritizes. I mean, he might be leaving a little bit of money on the table to go to a better situation.
He's 28 as well. That's another thing that this is kind of the time. I mean, I don't anticipate him having, you know, we'll see who the Knicks end up drafting as well next year. You know, he actually got playing time. He played well. I don't know if that's a guarantee he's going to do that again, and especially when he's a year older. So, you know, probably makes sense to opt out, but it wasn't by any means a clear decision.
We should also, you talked about who the Knicks draft. There is some reporting that they're considering or trying to move up. We'll see if that actually happens on tomorrow's podcast and on the draft on Thursday. But, I mean, one of the things that was interesting to me is that I think it was Ian Bagley had the report that they're looking at Mo Bamba. First of all, that sounds really Knicks. He is also, Bamba grew up in Harlem, so he has a connection to the area. But you and I both think Kristaps Porzingis' most likely position after this ACL injury, at least for the short term, but probably for a long term, is center. So, of course, the Knicks will trade up and draft a center.
Well, and talking about the whole trading up aspect, what dovetails a little bit with that Begley report is John Gavone's piece on the Grizz potentially heating up now, trying to trade number four. And with Doncic looking increasingly likely to go to the Hawks at three, the Grizz are talking to no fewer than seven teams, apparently. And I think we talked about this conception, too, that especially with Memphis, some of the guys around that range not wanting to go there, that they would look to trade down and look to trade Parsons at the same time. Now, some of these deals that are being floated, and I'm guessing that this is probably coming, this report is coming from the Memphis side, you would think, because the deals being discussed are pretty favorable to Memphis, number one, and number two, how else are you going to know that seven teams are involved in the bidding unless that's coming from Memphis, who's receiving all of these offers, apparently? The report is, you know, maybe until they're on the clock at four and they know who's there, the offers won't be their best. But some of the things that were being talked about, and really, Parsons is such a bad contract that even if you're talking about, okay, we'll take back Biombo from Orlando, right? Like one of the things that Gavone said is Orlando is being asked to include Evan Fournier, who has 3 years left on his contract, but can actually play in exchange for Parsons. And, you know, who knows what else to match the salary necessarily. And then Memphis would drop down from four to six. That two spot drop is not nearly enough for me to also dump Parsons and give up someone who can play. The additional amount that Parsons is owed over Biombo, even that is probably, I mean, Biombo is making $18 million a year, a little bit more than that. But even that to me is almost, you know, if you look at it as $12 million extra in dead money to drop down two slots when Memphis, you know, probably is in a bind at four anyway, because the guys that they would want to select haven't wanted to go there and work out or give them the medical, or in the case of Bamba, have actually specifically said they don't want to play there. So I think what's being floated so far is not realistic. That Parsons contract is just too toxic. Even if you're talking about the Knicks moving up from like four to nine, it's just, I'm not sure who's going to be the matching salary. I mean, maybe it'd be Joakim Noah going back, but then going down from four to nine, like, why does Memphis want to do that? This is a tough trade, a tough conception to come up with. If you're really insisting on including Parsons, like, that's just tough. I mean, it's just, he's too bad of a contract. I don't think that there's much that could be sent back. Maybe Biombo would be fair, but even that might be too much to give up if you're the Magic, especially because we'll talk about our draft board in a little bit, but I don't see a huge difference between four and six in this draft necessarily, at least personally, maybe the teams.
And with Orlando specifically, I mean, I guess it would depend who's on the board, but I don't see them as being super into a particular person who might go at like five. You know, there are circumstances, of course, where that can happen. And what I think is interesting about this situation is that the best player to fall in terms of value proposition of trading this pick is Luka Doncic, who is also the player Memphis should take if he falls to them.
Yeah.
So it's a challenging proposition. Like, I mean, if he's the one who ends up falling there, I don't know if that's going to happen. But man, I'm excited for it, and we'll see where it goes.
Last little bit here, following up on yesterday's Kawhi report. Stephen A. Smith reporting that Kawhi specifically told Greg Popovich in their meeting yesterday that he does not want to be there. That's bad for San Antonio. And Stephen A., he does talk to a lot of people, despite kind of being a blowhard on TV and having this shtick. You know, I don't think that his reports are necessarily that erroneous, despite his crazy persona. So, let's talk a little draft prospects here. We may not go quite as long as we did on some of the guys yesterday, but let's give it a start here. Where do you want to start first?
Let's start with Miles Bridges. He is a swingman. That's the term I use for twos and threes. Out of Michigan State, 6'7", 220, with a 6'10 wingspan, 6% body fat. And Bridges is interesting. 2 years at Michigan State, could have come out after last year, decided not to. Came back, 22 PER, 572 true shooting, 27 usage, 36% from three on about six attempts per game, 85% from the line on 3.2, though it is worth noting he shot up from 69% to 85% from the line. So we'll see what really is the truth there. And with Bridges, I see him, sorry, I'm going to have to use some first names here. With Miles Bridges, I see him as kind of a piece that you have, not necessarily a centerpiece, but it's nice to have just a capable player at the two and the three, because there aren't that many of those in the league.
Yeah, you know, he's a real interesting guy. If he just had a little bit longer arms and a little bit better hands defensively and was just a little bit more active as a playmaker defensively, I would be like really high on him. But 6'6", 6'9 wingspan, 8'7.5 standing reach. I mean, that's below average for a small forward. And now what he does have, though, is a very strong body at 220. And he also has very quick feet, comparing him as we're obviously going to do with the name similarity and also as potential 3-and-D type of players in this range in the draft. Comparing him with Mikal Bridges, I think his feet are actually a lot quicker, and that he also is strong enough that, you know, if it's kind of a race to get to the spot, he's able to prevent the guy from getting a shoulder pass, turning the corner, knocking him backward. I thought that he had a lot of plays where he was able to cut off the guy's first move with his chest really well, and just his feet for a guy with his build were very nice. And that's the type of player that, you know, even if you don't have great length, has a fair amount of switchability. In the post, he's got to get stronger, play a little bit more intensely, but I think he's strong enough and has the build to do that. I think he was very concerned with not fouling this year, which in some ways is good, you know, especially out on the perimeter. He really made a big show of keeping his hands back, but probably did that a little bit too much in the post. Didn't want to play physically, didn't want to get into foul trouble. You know, he only gave up 11 points on 20 isolation possessions. You know, not a huge number. I wouldn't put too much stock in that number with only 20 possessions. But in those 20 possessions, I think I only saw him get beat all the way to the rim once, you know, without getting a decent contest. Now, the arms are a little short, so if he does cut the guy off and he can still, a guy can kind of rise up over him a little bit. And he doesn't have amazing hands, as I said. Interesting that he had 43 blocks as a freshman, only 26 as a sophomore. I'm not sure, I didn't watch much of him as a freshman, but he played on the perimeter a lot more this year, cleaning the glass at a nice piece. And there was some follow-up analysis of that by the Stepien on what his free throw rate was when he was playing the four versus the three. It was really low at the three. It was much higher at the four. So I don't know if he can be a real, you know, start as a combo forward in the NBA just due to the lack of length, but I think he can guard a lot of guys. I mean, I think he's got a better chance of guarding some of those power wings than, say, Mikal Bridges, just due to being a little bit stout, having a little bit quicker feet. What did you think of him defensively?
I liked him overall. A note that I had, I thought he did a nice job moving his feet, but there were times when it seemed like he didn't do enough to stop the guy from getting where they wanted to go. So I think some of that is the driving to a pull-up type of play,
yeah,
where he's kind of there, but he's not necessarily preventing that, especially when he ended up on smaller guards. So the word that I came up with in at various moments with him, it originally started with Miles Bridges' handle, was that he's functional. Like he does a lot of things, you know, pretty well. He can hit open shots. He can do a little bit with the ball in his hands. And defensively, I think it's the same way. Like he's not going to be a blanket to, that you throw over a guy. But if you put him into different assignments, you want him to work. Kind of like what I talked about yesterday with Mikal Bridges, where I don't think you want him as the guy on Kawhi, on whoever the other team's ace forward is. But if he's on the other player, I think he'll be okay.
I don't think he's going to be a lockdown guy there, but I think he can be an adequate option on those type of players. I mean, not every team has a lockdown guy at the three, and I think he can be there just because of his strength. I think he's got a decent chance of not getting overpowered, and he's got a decent chance of cutting guys off, even if, you know, maybe he's not going to be able to get the best contest on some of those plays you mentioned where a guy is getting to a spot and rising up. In conventional pick and roll defense, we didn't see it a lot because they switched a lot. You know, he was playing at the three. They were switching everything with Jaren Jackson, for example. But the few times we did see him try to fight over a screen, I thought it looked decent. And I think he plays physically, he plays intensely. He likes to keep his hands on guys off the ball. And you know, I didn't see him make a ton of mental errors. The blocks thing is interesting, you know, to have those that many blocks as a freshman, not as much as a sophomore. Let's turn to his offense now. What were your thoughts there?
So his shot goes in, but there were times where it just looked a little bit weird to me, and especially that was true on pull-ups. Granted, I don't think Miles Bridges is going to be taking a ton of pull-ups in the NBA. You know, I don't think the situation is going to present itself. And his isolation game, he did okay. You know, he did well a little bit under a point per possession there. But I saw more just like those deep twos going in. And I'm not necessarily thinking that those are going to go in all the time. But he's active offensively. I thought that he actually, when I watched him, I thought he could do some nice work as a smaller cog in a bigger machine offensively. Had some good cuts and moved around and was, you know, like, and could basically force his guy to work, which is definitely a good thing for a complementary offensive piece. His handle, this is where I came up, where I started calling him functional. It's not a fancy handle, but it gets him where he needs to go. And also something I liked from him, I saw it a couple times in the film, was Bridges getting an early seal in transition, which I love for a guy his size to do when the opportunity presents itself.
Yeah.
And I think coaches should encourage players his size to do that all the time.
Yeah, the Jason Richardson, he was one of the guys who would do that when he was in Phoenix, and Steve Nash would hit him with the hit-ahead pass. If he was ahead of the pack, he would just try to get a deep seal and post up. I like that. His post game, yeah, again, I would say functional. I mean, hopefully he can get to a little more power game, you know, really more against switches potentially if you're putting your one on him to put more length on some of the team's best ball handlers. Maybe you could punish there. He showed somewhat of a skill level. You know, you had a couple of Dirk fades, some decent moves in the post, but not really, you know, a dominating player down there. Again, you know, he was playing at the three most of the time, not really going to have the space to attack the way you might in the NBA. His finishing around the basket was interesting. We mentioned the low free throw rate, and you know, there are not many guys with as low of a free throw rate as he's had who have been successful in the NBA. Although, again, you know, the lack of space was part of it. But another part of it was just that when he gets to the rim, he can go up pretty soft. He'll try a lot of flips and scoops and try to slip the ball underneath the defense. He gets a lot of rise, especially off of 2 feet. As a 1 foot jumper, not really nearly as explosive. You know, he can get up for some alley-oops off of 2 feet. He can fly in from the wing off of 2 feet, but off of 1 foot, not really quite the finisher. He does have a nice right hand though for a lefty, which is always nice to see. And then his shooting, you mentioned his form doesn't really lend itself to jumpers off the dribble. His shot selection was definitely questionable at times. I mean, you'll see that with a lot of guys who are like, oh, I'm going to play the three this year and I'm going to prove how good my perimeter skills are. And that just leads to taking a lot of bad contested twos. He was much better as a shooter with time and space. I mean, I know that's true for everyone to some degree, but the way his form is when he was rushing it, it did really seem to degrade things quite a bit. And he shot it much better. Unguarded catch and shoots, he was 18 out of 38, 70% e-field goal percentage on those. Now, worth noting too that for Synergy, this is just manually logged. So when a shot goes in, you're probably just more likely to log it as unguarded. I mean, the threshold between guarded and unguarded is not a bright line necessarily when you're talking about a jump shot. But you know, even on catch and shoots that were guarded, pretty decent percentage, 54% adjusted field goal. I think where it really went downhill for him was in his jumpers off the dribble, which he took a fair amount of. It was 98 of those attempts and was only 34% from the field, 38% field goal percentage on those shots. But hopefully that's not a shot that he's going to need to take as much in the NBA. And then his passing for a player of his ilk to be close to 3 assists a game, not bad either.
Yeah, I thought there were some plays where he forced a pass or he missed it, but he did throw some really nice ones. There was one to Jaren Jackson in transition that was just absolutely gorgeous, and that's great to see from a player who's going not going to be asked to do that very often, just to have some of those good ones in there. And it seemed to be, as you mentioned this, but every once in a while I'd be like, man, how many turnovers does this guy have? Where sometimes it was bad passes, sometimes it was just, you know, something with his dribble. But yeah, Bridges is interesting. And again, positional value here. I could certainly see him just, even if he's just in the league for a long time, and I'm sure some people will compare him, not because they're the same physically, but just because of certain elements of their game and they went to the same college, to like Gary Harris. Gary Harris, not a spectacular player, but a good player and a functional player, and he's incredibly valued for the Nuggets. And Bridges has the potential to do more than that because he's a little bit bigger, and we'll see what he can do with the ball in his hands at the next level.
Yeah, I don't know if he would be there at 14. But I think he would be a great pick for the Nuggets at 14 if they can get him. He fits right into exactly what they need. As you mentioned, Gary Harris, but I would not necessarily anticipate that he will be around them. All right, we'll get to the rest of these guys, but first this from Lending Club. Whether it's unexpected repairs, medical expenses, credit card debt, sometimes a little money can make a big difference, and you can get it at lendingclub.com. They'll give you access to low rates on loans of up to $40,000 for almost any purpose. It's a lot easier than going to a bank, lowers your interest rate compared to credit cards, and it's just way easier as well. You go to lendingclub.com, you enter the amount that you need, and you find out just in minutes whether you're approved or not. So it's really, if you're someone who can use a loan like this, not gonna be a huge opportunity cost in terms of time to see if you can get approved or not. And when you go and check your rate at lendingclub.com/capspace, it's not going to impact your credit score. So you really have nothing to lose other than just a couple of minutes. And it's something that could save you a lot of money or really provide you some cash when you need it. For more than 10 years, Lending Club has helped millions of people with over $31 billion in loans. Once again, the way to get started with them is lendingclub.com/capspace. Easy to remember because we talk about cap space all the time on the program. Once again, lendingclub.com/capspace. All loans made by WebBank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Who's next on our list here?
Let's go to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, combo guard height. I was going to say combo guard stars, but he's only 180 pounds, 6'6", 180 pounds, 7-foot wingspan, 8'8 standing reach, which is ridiculous. And the biggest question with Shai is whether you believe in his shooting percentages, because he shot 40% from three, but it was only on 57 attempts for the entire season. And he shot 82% from the line on a much larger pool of attempts. If you think that shooting is anywhere close to real, even at the low volume, then he's something interesting. But if you think that's more like the Duke power forwards, where it was a couple of shots going in that might not be able to go in at the NBA level, his appeal wanes significantly.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to look at it. I was more impressed by him offensively and less impressed than I expected to be defensively, in particular defense. I was quite disappointed with what I saw on film, although the potential, I believe, is there, but he's got a long, long way to go. Let's say the shooting is decent. I mean, and there's some reasons to really like that. 40% on threes overall, but only 23 out of 57, not a ton of attempts, less than two per game. Does get to the foul line a reasonable amount, 46% free throw rate. And one thing that I actually was more impressed by than I thought I would be was his jump shooting off the dribble, which is something that we didn't see from 2-point range. We didn't see a ton of that. When we saw him at the Hoop Summit, though, I think both of us were surprised that he was as low ranked at the time as he was, because I thought he was a very steady, solid player, and I was really surprised that they played, I think it's Lindell Wiggins is the guy's name, over him. Those jumpers off the dribble from 2-point range, and with the spacing they had, I mean, remember we talked about this with Knox, where really Knox was the only guy on this team who would be out there who could make a three. Maybe they'd have Wenny and Gabriel out there a little bit, but he was, you know, just an okay shooter at the four. Diallo and a traditional five weren't going to hit shots. But his ability to kind of just get to his spot and either shoot a step back or shoot over a smaller player, I thought actually looked pretty good. I think that could be a way that he could bump his scoring, because that's really the question of, all right, can this guy be a really good, you know, an above average offensive point guard? That's the big question to me about his development. And I'm split on that because he has a lot of nice skills. But as you mentioned, you know, just you wonder whether he can create quite enough shots really to be a guy who's your primary pick and roll ball handler your primary guy initiating the offense. I tend to think that you're looking at him more as a number two guy, as an off the dribble shot creator. And I think, you know, his three pointer doesn't get a lot of them off, as we noted. And you would think that you would get more of them off because they have all these other guys that can't shoot and be collapsing in on him. So, you know, he would be open. But he's just got, from three, he's got a much slower release, much more of a set shot than he has from two. And again, it goes in. I think it looks pretty good. But can he speed that up, make it a little bit more versatile? That's a big question mark.
It's also exacerbated by teams going under on him pretty regularly,
right,
when he was at Kentucky. And so, like, you're seeing the way that the asset, the, like, kind of the risk management proposition that all these teams face in Kentucky. And Kentucky had all these structural problems in terms of their offense. And one of the other things I liked from Shea was that he had some smart cuts. He had some, like, nice off-ball stuff. And so you're like, oh, okay, you know, you could do a little bit with that. Had an inside-out move in transition that I really liked. So it was something with his handle. Something else that bothered me with him is I thought there were too many circumstances, and a lot of this could be spacing related, where Gilgeous Alexander just threw up low chance stuff on drives, you know, scoop shots, like all that sort of stuff, where it just didn't have as much of a chance. He ended up the year, I'm using the Stepien shot charts, at 58% at the rim. I wish that number were a little bit higher. It could be with better spacing. But I think you're right, though, that the big question, and I actually have a Danny Storytime connecting with my Real GM piece on this for Patreon subscribers, is creating separation. And I still don't love him as a creator of separation.
Yeah, and then you get into trouble because he actually can really operate in pick and roll, especially with his height. Excellent at finding the weak side shooter when they would help off of him. You know, he definitely makes some pro passes, left hand, right hand, hook passes, pretty decent craft getting into the lane. I mean, you mentioned he throws up some kind of low percentage finishes, but he also has a pretty high skill level on those. You know, he's got the scoop shots.
Yeah, I should have mentioned that.
He's got, you know, jumping off of the wrong foot, kind of wrong footing shot blockers, inside hand foot finishes where he's kind of going along and then takes a big step and reaches in to get under the guy's arm for a layup. But really, almost zero physicality right now on both ends. And it's, I think, that's something that's going to be important, is to just be able to create a little bit more space for his two-point jumper as a way against a smaller defender to create some shots. And then you mentioned the big one as well is, you know, can he shoot a three ball if they go under? I think he'll be able to take a long two if they go under. But a three is tough because, again, he doesn't have much versatility to that three-point shot in the way that he does from two-point range. Should we turn to his defense now?
One other quick thing I wanted to mention. I was surprised that his best dribble stuff, generally there was that in and out I liked, was more up and back rather than side to side. Like, he had a couple of nice hesitations and step back type things, and that can work. You know, certainly there have been players that have succeeded with that in the NBA, but I always like guys that have more side to side shake, just because it's a lot, it can work against a wider variety of players, and it opens up more in terms of what the defense can give you.
He's also got a pretty solid floater. It can look awkward at times, so more of a 2 foot floater, but it seemed to go in. You know, I think that's something that can be a passable shot for him. And I agree with you. I mean, I think if they're switching him, especially with a guy who's got more size than him, that he's going to be really hard pressed to create a good shot. Let's turn to the defense. I mean, you assume, like, okay, 6'6", great length, almost a 7 foot wingspan. Seems like he's pretty quick. Like, you know, he's got to be a good defender, right? Like, that's got to be a big part of the appeal. He just seems like the type of player where, oh yeah, it's the defense. But, you know, just really not a guy who plays with much effort. You know, I mean, he as a one-on-one guy, I mean, if you watch his possessions in isolation, really unimpressive. I mean, he's just like not even in a stance, just getting blown by all the time, or, you know, again, the lack of physicality in part due to his small frame. If he does cut the guy off, he's kind of doing it as he's running alongside him, and then he gets too much momentum going away. If he gets a little bit of a shoulder into him, he gets totally knocked off, and the guy gets a wide open jumper from the free throw line. I mean, I say he has a tendency to get out of his stance. That's if he even ever gets in one in the possession to begin with. You know, every once in a while, he can kind of get a steal with his long arms, but you don't really see him getting into the ball at all. His ability to get over screens was negatively impacted by that. You know, we didn't really see him again, you know, really getting close to the ball, being able to squeeze through between the ball handler and the screener. Died on a lot of screens. And then, yeah, he has some length, but as a switch guy, if you're the size that he is, I mean, you got to battle a lot harder, you know, whether it's fronting guys, whether it's just not getting knocked backwards in the post, even if it's just like, you know, being handsy and making the guy uncomfortable that way, going for strips. I mean, we just did not see it as all. Now, maybe he can get there. You know, maybe he has quick enough feet. I mean, there are very few occasions when you really saw him move his feet, but he's got a very long way to go. I would not count on him being a good defender at the NBA level based on what I saw. I mean, he's got good length to close out at times. You know, definitely has some tools, but whether it's fundamentals, maybe it's fundamentals, maybe he just doesn't have it in him. Maybe it's just a lack of intensity. Maybe his feet just aren't that quick. You know, you never know exactly what it is. But, I mean, what he put on film was not very impressive to me. I think I'm lower on his defense than maybe some others.
What really concerned me was what I call a worst of both world circumstances. So when he got up more on the guy, he got blown by a lot. And then when a lot of times he was too far back, and then guys would pull up, guys would just take the original three. And you can't have both of those things happen. You know, you need to be able to deter at least something. And that tied in with something that I noticed, which was that Gilgeous Alexander did a nice job when he was in a situation where the guy could only do one thing. So that could be it was late in the shot clock or he'd picked up his dribble. Okay, if the guy picks up his dribble, you can get right up on him, put your big arms up, can't do a whole heck of a lot. The problem is that happens very infrequently in a situation of leverage. So he can do that. And I'm sure with time, with development, with coaching, Gilgeous Alexander can get a lot better, but he's not there now. And so I was very reluctant. You know, I was scared of him because for those who've listened to the podcast for a long time, one of my blind spots is these kind of toolsy guards that can defend but aren't really point guards. You know, like I had XM number one in his class. He kind of fit in this, at least from a physical standpoint originally. But I felt a little bit better after I watched his defense because I'm like, okay, he's not the type of guy that I fall in love with too often as much as the other guy.
Yeah, so again, we're only going to do the top eight in our board. But I wouldn't say that any of these guys that we've looked at, I'm like super high on breaking into that top eight. You know, that's I'm sure a lot of that is just groupthink because we've been looking at these mock drafts for a while. And certainly the odds are that one of them or more of them will be better than the players selected above them. But just as far as I'm thinking about it, like there's no one in this kind of 9 through 15 range that we're looking at that I'm just absolutely wowed by at this point. And I think if Shea were a little bit better defensively, if he really were like, oh man, this guy's like really good, and I really could count on that happening. I'm not saying that can't happen, but I'm especially with his length, but I might start to feel that way about him. But, you know, I kind of see him as average defensively, average offensively. You know, maybe he could be a starting point guard. He's got some size. Hope the shooting works out. If it doesn't, then, you know, maybe it's a real question mark about whether he could even be good enough offensively to be a starting point guard in the NBA. So just a lot of question marks with him, even though I'm a fan of his game. I really like a lot of his skill level, his pick and roll operation, some of the skill finishes that he has. There are maybe just a few too many question marks about him. And that's how you get guys more in this range is when you really, they don't have that one absolutely dominating skill and they also have some question marks about them. Anything else on him?
No, let's move on to Lonnie Walker. So Lonnie Walker, Miami, 6'5", 196 pounds with a 6'10 wingspan. And Walker, you know, so 1 year at Miami, 16.3 PER, 527 true shooting, 22 usage, 35% on 5 threes a game, 74% on just 2 free throw attempts per game. And that's something that I wanted to kind of start with Walker is that it seemed to me like when he drove a lot without much of a plan. So he would just go into the space and then he didn't have the ability to react really to what was going on. And so sometimes he would throw up some crap. Sometimes he would get caught for a turnover and he doesn't have like a great handle or a great vision. So he wasn't able to convert some of the gifts that he has into production that really helped his team.
Yeah. And when you look at that too, on the defensive end, a steal per game, you know, you'd hope that a guy like him with his tools, and his tools are massive. I mean, you know, the 6'10 wingspan, excellent dunker. He had the third fastest shuttle run at the combine, although a lot of the top 15 guys don't do that. But the third fastest three-quarter court sprint, 40-inch max vertical, 31.5 standing vertical, which is a pretty big difference between those two. Actually, I just look at the film for guys' verticals and to figure out how athletic I think they are rather than the numbers. But if there is a number to look at, I think the standing vertical is more important than the max vert. The standing vertical is usually off of 2 feet, though in the max vert, a lot of guys like to do it off of one. Yeah, he's a great NBA level athlete. You know, he'd be not the most athletic shooting guard in the league, but one of the more athletic. But basically, he's athletic and, you know, his shot from three doesn't suck. And yeah, it's kind of about it as far as where he is right now. But he obviously has a ton of potential. He feels more like kind of a guy. I mean, when you look at the inefficiency, that true shooting is awful. Schmitz wrote an article about how, you know, his situation at Miami was not good. But, you know, he's a guy where you watch him on film and he looks like really amazing. But then you look down, it's like, oh, yeah, the ball actually like didn't really go in the basket for anybody's guy.
Well, and then defensively, you're sitting there going, why can't this translate more? So like for me, one of the things I noticed was that, first of all, he's more reactive than proactive on defense, which happens a lot with a guy as young, you know, these young guys, not a big deal, but gets caught on screens kind of a lot. And he was getting beat by players who are way less athletic than he is. Like there was one play in the Duke game where Gary Trent Jr. just straight up beat him on a drive. And help defense ended up stopping the layup, so that ends up helping Lonnie Walker's defensive numbers, but it wasn't helped by him actually playing good defense. And then the thing that absolutely drove me insane with him, and this can be coached out, is he kept on freelancing off his own guy, but he wasn't really doing much helping. He was just kind of going off of his guy, something Kevin Knox did way too much as well. And like it was a play where he was helping to the center on a well-covered drive when his guy was in the corner and his guy just popped the three. And maybe there was some scheme stuff there. I, you know, there are always these issues when you talk about when a guy makes a kind of a strange decision or even does that a series of times, that it might be scheme, it might not be that. And I don't know Miami well enough to know what their idea was there. But it just frustrated me because it seemed like there was a lot of low-hanging fruit that he is remarkably adept athletically. Like, it seems like he's well-suited to picking that up, and a lot of it did not get picked up.
Yeah, I don't think we need to spend quite as much time on him. I'm not really comfortable just talking about his team defense when these, like, little power pack scouting reports, it's tough to get that great of a view at it unless you're watching, like, multiple full games, which we didn't have time to do for all these guys. He takes just some terrible shots. 18 out of 70 on jump shots off the dribble, 33% e-field goal percentage, 26% on guarded catch and shoots. And then when he actually got an unguarded catch and shoot, again, this is a really small sample, he's 12 out of 21, 86% e-field goal percentage. Again, we've talked about how unguarded can really be skewed potentially. Only 51% around the rim. I think he can improve that, though. You know, with his athleticism, he showed just some really quick hands finishing, like ability to like get the ball up quickly onto the glass. And if he could actually draw some more fouls, that 51% around the rim probably gets a lot better because some of those misses turn into foul shots instead. But it certainly is troublesome. I mean, 2 free throw attempts per game in 27.8 minutes. I mean, that is awful. Only started 18 out of 32 games as well for this Miami team. He's got some ability to work off the dribble, you know, not really much of a passer yet. 1.9 assists per game, and he had the ball in his hands quite a bit. Can pull up off the dribble, okay. Showed some nascent skills, but just, I mean, no idea how to play. Not really that impressive within the team concept offensively. So we'll see. I mean, he's got a lot of potential. My feeling, just a gut feeling, again, I don't have quite as good of a read on him because the physical ability and what he actually showed on the floor were just so divergent. You know, it could kind of go either way with him. My feeling is more that he ends up being kind of like a microwave guard off the bench than a starter. Although defensively, I thought his ability to move his feet on occasion could be impressive. But, you know, I don't necessarily see him being a great defensive player. You know, if he could be a guy who could guard the other team's one and get over screens and stuff, that might change his destiny a little bit as well. But he's got a long way to go, but certainly has great physical tools. Anything else on him?
No, let's move on to Robert Williams. Williams was a player sort of like Daniel Gaffney has been this year, last year, where a lot of people expected him to come out of Texas A&M after his freshman year. He stayed for a second year. 6'10", 7'5" wingspan. And he is the only big that I can think of who could potentially be in the lottery or even in the top 20 who does not take threes. He was 0-for-12 on the season. And one of those concerns with him is Williams shot 47% from the free throw line. It was 59% his freshman year when he had more attempts. But you think about that and then combine that with, oh yeah, at Texas A&M, he was largely playing power forward because that's just what the roster construction was with the guys they had on the team this year.
Now, as much as that may have hurt him offensively, as a guy who doesn't shoot threes and was playing power forward, defensively, I think he showed some stuff out on the floor. I mean, the biggest appeal for him is his ability to move his feet defensively. You know, his overall block rate wasn't amazing, but he was a guy who I thought, you know, definitely was more impressive as a switch guy than Bamba, and even was playing kind of like a perimeter guy who's guarding a lot of stretch fours, even like getting out on the floor, like denying guys every once in a while, putting a little bit of pressure on the ball, even. I wouldn't quite put him as high as Jaren Jackson, but, you know, Jaren Jackson's a little bit different than Williams. I think Williams might even have slightly quicker feet than Jackson one-on-one. Overall, though, worth noting that his block stats are nowhere near the same as those guys. And he doesn't have quite the level of size that those guys do either. 6'9", 7'4", wingspan. But he's just very active defensively on the perimeter, which I liked. And, you know, one play that exemplified that was he was guarding a guy at the elbow who went to do a DHO, and the guard was beaten. So Williams felt like he had to jump out on the guard as the DHO was about to occur. And so he took that away, and the DHO actually never ended up happening. The guy faked it. It would have been open, but Williams took it away. And then Williams had taken a couple of steps away from the guy who was guarding with the ball. That guy was like, oh, I'm open now. I'm going to shoot this jumper. And Williams got back and blocked his jumper. And so that's the sort of level of activity that he was able to flash on occasion. And he was able to really make guys look bad sometimes who tried to drive on him and block their shot. So, I mean, his technique isn't unbelievable as a switch defender. You know, it's not like he's just totally unbeatable, but he had some really, really nice defensive possessions. In the post, I thought he could have been a little bit better. You know, guys were able to go over the top of him, get into his chest, knock him back. Would have liked to see a little bit more from him there. As I mentioned, didn't...
Yeah. That said, I want to mention with his post-up. So the numbers on that were really bad, so I was expecting to see something worse. It was like 1.1 points per possession. And there were a couple plays where it was an early... He got ducked in on, and it was just sitting there going, like, you're too big for this to happen to you. But overall, I thought it was okay. You know,
it wasn't a disaster.
You think that it could go in that direction. And something I wanted to see if you saw this as well. I liked him better, and this ties up with that play you were talking about with the DHO. I liked him better as a hedge and recover guy than a switch player, but because of his activity, I thought he could get back surprisingly well. So do the like two beats on the player, allow your guy to get there. And there's a place for that in the modern NBA as well. I liked him in those circumstances, and he was better defending isolations than I would have expected. Didn't get blown by that much. Just as you said, the feet are pretty good. I don't think he's going to be a full-on switch defender, but he was better than I expected.
Yeah, I didn't have enough time really to get a good feel for how he is as a team defender, as a help defender. You know, that's something that's obviously very important as well. You know, didn't have the type of gargantuan block rate, although I did like some of the individual blocks that he would get, and I thought he had good timing on the ball.
I was impressed with his defensive rebounding, though.
Yeah.
I mean, so I thought he did a nice job getting there. And remember, he's mostly playing power forward, and they did a lot of the goddamn 2-3 zone, and he still had about 27% defensive rebound rate. And I liked him overall in the settings. The one big thing with him, and this is true with all of these guys, like Bamba's the same way, is that they don't need to be jumpy. And I think the pro coaches will get some of that out of them. And especially with a guy like Williams, whose feet are pretty good, just trust yourself that you're in position and put your damn hands up and he'll be fine.
Offensively, you mentioned the awful free throw shooting. He's 2 out of 30 from 3-point range in his career. Would take some jumpers, but I think he was like 6 out of 30 overall on catch and shoot jumpers, even 2-point range. He hit like one face up jumper in the post at one point. It seemed like he was trying to like be another one of these guys, like, oh, I'm playing the four now, see how skilled I am. And then, you know, isn't really in the post. His post game isn't like totally useless. You know, he can get to a hook, but it's pretty robotic. I don't expect him to do much of that. I mean, maybe if he gets a mismatch and gets deep position, you might throw it to him. Very low free throw rate as well, much lower this year. But the big appeal is his ability to finish around the rim. He will crush some two-handed dunks, and he's an extremely quick jumper. And gets his arms up very quickly and just fully extends them and dunks. I thought the quintessential play for him that so impressed me was he caught a big-to-big pass. He was pretty much under the rim, and the guy threw it maybe like, you know, a foot above his head. He catches it above his head, and, you know, this is a 6'9 guy, you know, it's not crazy, and he's able to just, without even moving the ball back down, just jump straight up from there and dunk it with two hands. I mean, that was just really impressive to dunk it that quickly, to explode that quickly without even having to bring the ball down at all, was extremely impressive. And he had a lot of those plays, can get up for some alley-oops as well. Hands are probably only average, I would say, more of a two-hand dunker than a guy who's really going to like reach back, cock it back and dunk it. But, you know, whether it's as a tip dunk threat, quick off the ground for those tip dunks, or pick and roll guy, I think he can be a very solid finisher in the NBA. And so that's the appeal of him, is guy you can switch on defense, rebound his position, protect the rim, and then, you know, be good enough offensively as a center to be a rim runner, good pick and roll player. Probably not going to beat switches himself offensively, but you know, I think he's another guy who you look at him and it's like, yeah, this guy could be a totally serviceable center, and it wouldn't shock me in the slightest if he ends up being better than, you know, a couple of the centers that were being talked about in you know, the top 7 or 8.
I had a moment when watching Williams that I just went, this is why you don't pay centers that aren't really good a lot of money, is because there are players like Robert Williams that will come into the league every year. And, you know, I think he'll probably get drafted in the late lottery or maybe just shortly thereafter.
Yeah, he's mocked to go 18 right now. But it is worth noting, actually, that behind him, there are really no big men of note in this draft.
Yeah, I mean, you get into like Wagner and Mitchell. At some point, I should talk about Mitchell Robinson a little bit.
Yeah, you want to do that right now? I know you had a chance to watch. You have more on Williams.
Let me say one note quick. Yeah, just a little note. I liked his catch radius. I thought that was nice. And also something that Williams does that Bamba's going to have to get better at, because Bamba, you know, is a lob throw as well. All these guys are. And Williams was better at clearing kind of the space to jump than Bamba was. And that's a very important part for these guys, because if you get a body on them and they don't, that takes away some of the lob threat. And I thought Williams did a better job adapting to that sort of pressure. And that's something you get all the time in the NBA.
Yeah, so Mitchell Robinson, he's now being talked about as being in the second round as a guy. Remember, he didn't play all this year, but was a highly recruited guy, was big on the AAU scene. You had some time to watch a little bit of him today. You want to just give us, you know, 90 seconds worth of your impressions of him? I mean, if he's going to go in the second round, we probably shouldn't spend that much time on him, but you did the work, so we might as well talk about it.
Sure. So at the Team USA training camp, he measured 7'1 with a 7'4 wingspan, 9'3 standing reach, and you see all that. I actually watched one of his just straight up high school games playing at, you know, some division in Louisiana, and it was hilarious because he only actually tried on defense maybe a fifth of the time. And then offensively, you know, if it was a play that involved him, you know, maybe it was an offensive rebound every once in a while, he would engage. He dropped 44, 18, 6 blocks and 3 steals in that game. And he just, and this was apparently a pretty good team in their division. And he just, so he's very physically gifted. He has confidence in his 3-point shot. And it took, I think, 2 NBA threes. There were 2 that, it's hard to sometimes tell with the high school line exactly where it is, but it looked like that. And just all the physical capability you could imagine it, but there were very little practical applications, because unlike a lot of these guys we talked about with Michael Porter, where we got to see them play against really good players of their age in international competition and the Hoop Summit and all that, Mitchell Robinson never got to do that. So I don't know exactly what he's going to be, but I think there's a lot of talent in there. And so I'm very intrigued to see where he goes and see what sort of resources they throw into him at the next level, because he's, and also we should mention, he's already 20. He's older than some of these guys. He's April 1998. So that's not as much of a like, oh, he's an unpolished gem at 18. He's a little bit older, but intriguing.
How would you describe his athleticism?
So it didn't pop like the guys in the lottery this year, but I would say it wasn't out of place with like an NBA. It kind of looked like an NBA player. It's hard to tell because he's basically playing against kids. Like the other guys looked like middle schoolers next to him, but it looked fine. It seemed like when he cared, he moved the floor well. And he never really moved his feet defensively because they didn't have him do anything. In that entire game, I watched an entire high school game, he did not set one screen. He did not box out once. So you didn't get a sense of a lot of the elements.
How is he
that
getting that
requisite
44 points?
Basically, his team actually had guys that could throw entry passes.
Yeah.
So they would just throw him an entry pass. He would keep the ball over his head and dunk on these little like Lilliputian kids. It was sort of amusing in that way, but also reminded me of why I'm very supportive of changing the age limit. But for the guys who don't play the competitive like Hoop Summit type stuff, the film on these guys gets a little bit raw. And so with some of that, yeah, you didn't see it much. But yeah, I thought the physical talent was there. When he cared, he chugged down the floor. He had a couple of plays where he actually like cared about getting there on a closeout. Like he blocked a three on a closeout from what felt like a mile and a half away. So those sorts of plays, you know, that's more straight line speed than lateral speed. But I thought he did a nice job.
Couple of stats on him from his Drafts Express profile. He averaged 20 rebounds per 40 minutes in EYBL, which is, as of that time in 2017, was the best ever in EYBL history. 8 offensive rebounds per 40, and then led the EYBL in blocks per 40, and was the second best shot blocker in EYBL history after Nerlens Noel. So, he's definitely got some potential. I mean, EYBL stats are being viewed as more reliable these days. So people are, ESPN, Kevin Pelton, putting them into their translation. So if that means something, that's, he's an intriguing guy. Looking forward to getting a little bit of a look at him, seeing where he goes. So should we do our boards here? I mean, I think the way we'll do it is we'll do 1 through 8 of the guys that we did the full scouting reports on, and, we can put him into tiers.
Yeah, I mean, this is a challenging draft for me in terms of tiers. In other years, I've gone, like, this is my old real GM style. I would do tiers that are historical. So, like, for me, tier one is, like, the likely superstars and all that. I didn't do that this year, mostly because I didn't take the time to piece it all together. So I just did tiers relative to each other. I'm not sure if that's how you did it.
That's precisely how I did it.
So, for me, tier one is two guys. Luka Doncic is my number one. DeAndre Ayton is my number two. Doncic, we talked about this a little bit because we covered those two guys in quick succession. Both of them are uncertain. Neither of them would be in that, like, Anthony Davis type of class as a number one pick, anything close to that. They would be in the next tier down because they each have significant question marks. Doncic, it's, creating separation, what he's going to be defensively, whether he can actually run an offense at the NBA level. And then with Ayton, it's whether he can apply his physical gifts, whether his recognition and his motor and all of that is good enough to shoulder what an NBA center has to do. So I ended up going Doncic over Ayton. I have those guys as really close. I don't think, some people think it's a no-brainer one way or the other. I do not feel that way, but I have Doncic.
So I'll give you my top two. Tier one is Luka Doncic by himself, just completely unprecedented production, ton of feel, great passer. I think just he's right up there for me. And I like a lot of these guys a lot, but Doncic to me is the clear number one prospect with that size and his skill level. Tier two for me is actually the other seven guys.
Wow.
Well,
okay.
Now, you know what? No, I shouldn't say that. That's not right. I didn't spend enough time on this. I probably should. But I would say tier two for me is 4 guys. At the top of it, I would have Trae Young, then Michael Porter, with a huge caveat that, that he's going to be the same player that he was in high school from a health perspective. I really...
Oh, I'll mention that. If Porter was the same player he was in high school, he would be number two for me, maybe even number one.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that's... And the stuff about the intel on him is not great, but, a 6'11 guy who can shoot with his finishing ability, he just has so much upside, and there aren't players like that that are around. A lot of this is based on the idea that center is a relatively fungible position in today's day and age. So Porter would be 3, DeAndre Ayton would be 4, Jaren Jackson Jr. would be 5. That's the end of my tier 2.
So we ended up in similar places, though the order differences are there. So I had Doncic and Ayton in a section. Then my tier 2 is Young, Jackson, and Porter. So the same guys, just in a little bit of a different separation. I ended up with Trae Young over Jaren Jackson, even though I think Young has a higher bust potential, because the top of the draft is about getting a superstar, and I think there is a substantially higher chance that Trae Young becomes a superstar than Jaren Jackson does, even though I like Jackson a lot.
Yeah.
Just the idea that this works for Trae Young, those players are so incredibly valuable in the league now, and they're very hard. They're hard to find, they're hard to cultivate, and once they exist, they're incredibly hard to get. Yeah. So it's worth it.
And for Young, this was confirmed for me by looking at, KP had a piece on just how generally college, what statistics in college translate best to the NBA, and assist rate was right up there, right? So, I mean, I think I said this while we did his profile, and please, if you haven't listened to that, you want to get a better idea of why I'm so high on the guy who is currently mocked to go number 12 by ESPN. His great passing is one. I mean, I think that's something that just is going to translate. It almost universally has for prospects. And then number two, just the gravity effects, whether it's transition, the effect that he had on Oklahoma's transition game. I'm worried if he goes number 12 that he almost just won't be enough of a priority for that team, and that, there is an investment with him, and I think he's also going to have a really rough first year, and that people are going to see his first year and be like, oh, you're full of shit, Nate. Like, he sucks. Like, what the hell were you thinking? But
like Jamal Murray.
Although I thought Marietta would be good for, but nonetheless,
we both did. But that's how people talk to us about
it. Right. But I mean, sure. You know, it's kind of more in that early stage, especially the point guards, to me, about flashes than it is consistency and being able to be efficient. But you know, if they're not going to give him the ball and let him push the ball and, you know, jack from 30 feet, assuming that the ball goes in, we don't know that it will, but hopefully that'll be the case. But I mean, I think he could really just revolutionize the team's transition game, a pick and roll game. I mean, he's not going to be Steph Curry. He's not going to be that good. Steph Curry, and there's an argument that Steph Curry is one of the 10 highest peaks in NBA history and may not have the longevity to be, you know, a real all-time great. But, you know, Trae Young is unlikely to reach that level. But, you know, poor man Steph Curry is not too bad if he can actually hold up. And I think I'm confident enough and the upside is high enough that that's why I have him as my number two overall guy. Porter, I mentioned already. Ayton, the defensive concerns are pretty massive. But at some point, you know, you can't ignore the production. You can't ignore that physicality. And I think, you know, especially with his quick feet, he should be able to get to be passable defensively, even if he's not elite. And then Jackson, you know, just his kind of Al Horford-like versatility is why I had him rounding out tier two.
So I'm guessing, well, I mean, beyond Trae Young, the most surprising thing for a lot of people there for you is Ayton at four, and I'll be the voice of commenters that I'm sure are going to come. Was Ayton being four, do you think that was more about him or more of you being positive about Trae Young and Michael Porter?
I think both. You know, it's just Ayton just didn't wow me. There's nothing about him where I was like, oh yeah, this guy is just going to be just so much of a winner in the NBA. Now, if we were talking about him as like a great defensive prospect, I think a lot of that would change. But it's just, you know, when you don't have a great defensive center, it's hard to have a good defense. So if he's only an average defensive center and he's not, doesn't have the greatest awareness, you know, I just can't get behind him that much. You know, I think he has a high floor with the points and rebounds and his physicality, but I'm just, you know, I'm not sure how exactly my vision of DeAndre Ayton, top 10 player in the NBA, like how that comes to be. I have trouble picturing, whereas with Porter, well, with Young, with Doncic, I can see that.
Yeah, I think the guy that, even though they're not similar physically, that I kept on thinking about when conceiving of where to put Ayton on this list is DeMarcus Cousins. Because Cousins, prodigiously gifted offensively, but, I mean, you still have all these questions about whether his overall apathy and weaknesses defensively. And I think Ayton, you know, the benefit of Ayton, like, if you're, it's kind of like rolling the dice again defensively, like with Cousins, where Cousins had some of the tools to be a good defender. He just never was. Maybe Ayton can turn that around a little bit. That's why I have him higher, is that I think there is a chance that he becomes decent, maybe even above average. I don't think he'll ever be like an all defensive guy. That would be a big shock to me. I'd love to see it, but I wouldn't expect to. So that's hard. And the point that kind of I think you're getting to is that if we're talking about a high offensive ceiling guy, you'd rather have a high ceiling point guard or even a perimeter player than a center, because it's just harder to make it work. But Ayton has the tools to be a kind of a new age offensive center, which I think is interesting.
So getting into tier three now, I really struggled with where to put Marvin Bagley. Obviously, the defense is just a massive concern for him. The fact that he's not really like that skilled of a back-to-the-basket guy is a concern. Not really having a defensive position is a big concern. But I do think with his athleticism, pretty great first step, pretty smooth jump shot that I think can get to be an asset for him in time. You know, I think that just his offensive upside starts to get to be a little bit too much to ignore in this area. And then I had Bamba at seven and Carter at eight. Now, it wouldn't shock me if Carter, and again, these guys are all in the same tier, so I'm very close. Wouldn't shock me if Carter ends up being better than both of those guys. I see both Bagley and Bamba as being very high-risk players. And Carter, I think, is a little steadier. And I also think that Carter's weaknesses moving his feet maybe aren't as much as some people are saying. I think he can get better in that area. Even if he's not a switch guy, I think he can be adequate as a pick-and-roll defender. Good kid, works hard, high skill level. But I think I'm still more about upside in the draft. I think Bagley with the offensive upside, Bamba with the defensive upside, I have them above him, even if I might have Carter with a higher median outcome than those guys.
I went Bamba first of that group for a similar thing for you. I just think the ceiling play is there enough, and I'm intrigued by what he could be. And then I went Carter over Bagley, mostly because...
I'm not shocked by that.
Yeah, expected value. And
would you have Bagley in a tier below those guys or no?
No. I mean, because the ceiling... you know, he's an intriguing player, and I think there are ways to kind of counteract some of the things that he's bad at, and I also think he can get a lot better. You know, if he works at it defensively, there's a lot that he can improve on. And the only other guy I'll mention, that's the eight that we're talking about. And I kind of put Bamba in a mini tier. I'm not sure that I necessarily have him in a tier above those guys, but I have him a little bit of a gradation. And part of the reason why I do that is that I have both Mikal Bridges and Miles Bridges theoretically as being in that same conversation. So that's why I wanted to differentiate, because I wouldn't take, probably, unless it was a very specific circumstance, take either of those guys over Bamba, but I could consider it for over Carter and Bagley, depending on circumstances.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I'm just not quite comfortable enough with those guys below, in terms, you know, having watched, you know, an hour of film on each of those guys instead of, you know, like 6 hours the way we did on some of these other guys. So I can't quite go there yet. Certainly, like I said, a number of those guys who are below these ones are likely to be better than at least some that we're talking about in the top eight here.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, we didn't go beyond this, but I wouldn't be surprised at all to see Robert Williams do very well. It's a lot of these situations, it's going to be about circumstance and where they end up. But I drew a little bit of a line in my head between him and some of the point guards and all that, just because I see the path for him as being a successful but not dominant player a little bit more clearly than I do for the point guards or Knox Walker, those type of guys.
All right, well, let's wrap things up here. Anything you want to talk about before we depart?
Yeah, a couple different things. So I released Danny Storytime Patreon segments on all three of the draft related pieces I wrote for Real GM. So those are on how I watch film, how I watch ball handlers, and defense. The defensive piece actually came out on Tuesday at Real GM. So each of those is in the 15 to 20 minute range. I actually went through and kind of, because two of the three were written before we started the film work. So I ended up using some context with those players. I randomly talked about Ben Simmons in the defensive one for a while. Also, the 30th of my offseason previews is up. The Lakers at the recently launched The Athletic Los Angeles, that is up now. And yeah, I think that's about it with the piece and everything else. And I'm really, really excited for tomorrow, because I mean, it is going to be interesting with the kind of reporting that it seems like the major outlets are going to be reluctant to announce stuff. We don't know exactly what that's going to look like, whether it's going to be not just the picks or whether there are going to be trades or whatever, but it'll be a little bit different. And there is so much uncertainty, it looks like, in this draft. And I have my own feelings now that we've done some of our film work, that I'm very intrigued to see where this turns out.
Yeah, as am I. We'll be back, of course, to wrap up the entire draft tomorrow night. And also worth noting, too, we did it for the Charlotte-Brooklyn trade today. As soon as I woke up, I updated our salary sheet. So that's going to be really useful if you want to be a Patreon subscriber for us through free agency. All the trades tomorrow, we'll be updating them in as close to real time as we can get. Talk to you all tomorrow when the NBA draft will be in the books.